Certainly. Thank you. If you have a question and you're using a speakerphone, please lift your handset prior to making your selection. If you have a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. If at any time you wish to cancel your question, please press the pound sign. Please press star 1 at this time if you have a question. There will be a brief pause while the participants register. Thank you for your patience. The first question is from James Allison with Barclays. Please go ahead.
Good morning. Just looking, obviously lots of moving parts here with the what some might be one-time expenses in the quarter, some going to drag on to 2019. What's your sense on from a high level, kind of reestablishing EBITDA growth as we progress through 2019? Obviously, insurance premiums going up, going to be a bit of a headwind. Just wanted to kind of get your thoughts around that.
Yeah, well, the torque that we didn't get, some of that goes away if, I'll start with NSA, if we're now in the EBIT and EBITDA frame that we thought we were at last year, that covers a lot. The Caribbean business, I talked about a couple of items that were challenged, but the overall cost of this business combined with Right Way is a growth business for us with no significant margin pressure that we see. So it should grow, and when we look at the bottom line, it's growing beyond the insurance rate of increase. So that, you know, looking at the insurance rate by itself, that's one cost line, but we've got more than enough offsets, mostly at the gross profit dollar line. So that's where that is. Giant Tiger, it's not a big factor either way, except that we are uptrending. I mean, you know, when I said that it was the poorest performer, it was still an improving poor performer, and we see that continuing in Q1. So on a relative basis, Giant Tiger in our plan is going to give us lift because we're coming off some very poor numbers in 2019, and our optimism is, I think, grounded because of the cycle through effect and no additional pricing pressure that we see in the market anyways. When I get to Northern Canada, it's all about growth, and there's an insurance part to that. But over a much larger business, it's not as impactful in terms of what we need to offset. And there's really no area of the business that doesn't have growth potential in Northern Canada in terms of the categories we sell. We've got our convenience stores that are opening. The five we opened in the fall, we've got 5 to 6 opening this year. So there's a bit of lift there as well in terms of EBITDA growth. And then in Alaska, it's kind of a steady state, but there's growth with an expected, we don't know how big, but a PFD increase coming this fall. And just a very good lockdown approach to that business. Bethel, our main market, has got very robust growth going on. We're looking at adding 1 or 2 stores there, perhaps getting back in the liquor business. So those are some of the things. We just bought a pharmacy in Rankin Inlet, and it's helping as well. We've got maybe 1 or 2 that more we can do this year. So there's a number of factors that give us confidence in EBITDA growth that offset insurance. And I guess the other way to look at this is, you know, when we look at where are the pressures that would drive down EBITDA, you know, the big one we had last year, you know, the big one that stood out anyways was NSA, and we think that's controlled and not recurring. The other ones I mentioned on price management, it's now behind us. So that issue with NSA, pardon me, with NCR, we can look at it two ways. You can say you're permanently impaired, your margins aren't that high. We're saying, well, no, they're not that high, but now as we dig in, about half of that should be that high, and maybe the other half shouldn't, but that's a one-time thing. So from this point on, the good news is that we will manage our margins better. This pricing system will give us that ability. We have to be careful now in the stores that aren't as perhaps stable operationally that they're watched more closely. But the other 85% of the northern stores and all of the AC stores in Alaska will benefit from this. So there is, in our payback for that pricing system, we had expected that there'd be price optimization benefits, and that's built into our EBITDA growth as well.
Okay, great. Thanks. And so, I mean, it sounds to me like there might be some adjustment in Q1, but kind of after that, you feel like there's some good tailwinds to push you through the year. Does that seem like a fair characterization?
Yes, and you know, there's something I should have mentioned. We have it referred to in our report to shareholders. I'm just going to pick it up here because it's important. Structurally, you know that we set up the two presidents. We actually have three, one on the airline, but we set up the structure, and I think it's really working. It needs to be managed. But we've moved. We have a president of international, one of Canada retail, and the president of international has dug in and completely aligned with his decision to move our office to close our office in Bellevue, and to move our office for Costulus to South Florida, and to move back to Alaska. When we bought Costulus 10 years ago, we consolidated buyers into Bellevue. We're going to move the buyers back to Anchorage and put leadership back into Alaska to drive that business and do the same for Costulus. South Florida, being, we have more upside, we feel, across the Caribbean than the Pacific, so that's the closest place and the most important place to be to serve that market. There's going to be cost incurred in Q1 for that relocation because we're closing an office and people are going to leave our organization. They'll have stay-on bonuses till September. The ones who don't relocate for different reasons, either up to Anchorage or down to South Florida, and then we're going to hire new people, and there's going to be moving costs, et cetera. And it's going to, well, we'll disclose it in Q1, but I'm just telling you that's going to be a charge in the quarter.
Great.
So I just thought of that because it's in the outlook, and when you started to ask me what could happen, that's one thing that's going to happen.
Thank you.
Thank you. And the next question is from Matt Bank with CIBC. Please go ahead.
Hey, guys. Thanks. I guess first, there's a mention of the early SNAP payments, and I'm just wondering, if you could quantify that, and, if that leads to a lower comp store sales number in Q1.
It will lead to a lower comp store sale. It's tough to quantify because now, we've got the SNAP is back in for March. It looks like it had a bigger impact in Alaska, but there's some other positives going on there. So suffice to say, it'll be a factor. I don't know how big it'll be. It's hard to say right now.
Okay. So as I look at, how the comp, was almost 10% just in that one international subsegment. Was SNAP a big part of that, or it was all the other things you talked about?
It was a factor. So I it's a good question. I don't have the number. If I was ballparking, it could have been worth a couple of points.
Okay, thanks. There's a lot of moving parts here, but I guess in terms of the gross margin in 2019, mm-hmm. can you just share sort of how you're thinking about that between the two geographies or segments, I should say?
Yeah, so we still see, and I was, as I said earlier, because we think that those margin hits in Q4 and the year-end adjustments we did our fiscal counts for Northern Canada, we're going to get at least half of that back. So there'd be a pickup in margin in Northern Canada on that alone. Blend-wise, it's a little bit different because when I shift to general merchandise, part of the thing that happens when you've got good spending is you're going to sell more big ticket at a lower margin. So our modeling would show that there's some potential margin erosion, but gross profit dollar growth in our general merchandise business. When you net it out, we're probably flattish on the gross profit side in Northern Canada. In the Caribbean, we expect margin gain. We think we bottomed out in Barbados, and with St. Martin now open for a full year, we expect to get a good control of that operation, basically normalize it, and get a margin recovery there. So there is some margin recovery expected in Costulus. AC is stable, flat in Northern Canada, and same thing with Giant Tiger. So it's really, again, back, it's about growth, about top-line growth, and good OPEX control, and no surprises on gross profit.
Okay, thanks very much. And I'm just going to squeeze in one on North Star. So, I mean, you talked about getting to this $8 to $10 million free cash flow. The ATR is flying. The maintenance is running. Is it fair to say that you're at that run rate right now?
Today?
Yeah.
This instant? Yes.
Okay.
But not. But the plane, it's been 10 days. So if you had asked me that a month ago, I'd say no. So it's kind of okay. We're here, and you know what? I'm not saying it, not to be facetious, because and it's almost a joke now with the president. I call him every day. Is the plane still flying? But he, you know, not to bug him, but that's the thing. That plane has to fly. The maintenance has to be in house, and it is. So we are steady state today. That's the answer.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. The next question is from Michael Van Elst with TD Securities. Please go ahead.
Hi. So thanks for the rundown on the misses, but given how fast it was and given how important it is, I just want to kind of go through them quickly and just make sure that I've captured it properly. So in Northern Canada, you talked about a $3 million hit and from the NCR side, the pricing systems, and half of that you expect back next year, the other half you don't?
At this point, yes.
Okay. And then the 1 million freight overage, you expect that to come back as you'll adjust prices for it.
Yeah, we already have.
Okay. The Caribbean, the 1.8 million is that considered one time in nature then?
Yes.
Okay. And that's already out of the numbers?
Yes.
Okay. And then the NSA, you said as of the last 10 days, you're kind of at a run rate where you had that, I think you said $2.5 million hit in Q4, and that was to EBITDA.
Yeah, and that's against plan, of course.
Yeah. Okay.
A lot of what I'm describing is against plan, but.
Okay, so you'll have for the first, for most of Q1, you probably aren't running at that rate, but starting in Q2, you expect to be back.
Right. Q1 will be 50-50.
Okay, And then the utilities and insurance, you said $3 million impact in Q4 for utilities and insurance, or was that just utilities?
It's both, and they would be the majority would be utilities, but it's also, I mean, we lumped it together. It's kind of the segue into we are going to have a large insurance increase in 2019.
Okay, so the utilities was tied mostly to the cold winter, which continued in Q1.
Right.
So utility costs are still higher, so you're not expecting necessarily to get that back in Q1, but maybe by Q2, Q3, you're kind of normalized?
Yeah, well, it's a different season and it's a different situation. It's not comparable. I mean, the challenge for us, and we've escalated because the government money available, and also just because it's a big number, is what else can we do in energy efficiency? But that's that'll be next Q3, Q4, in case we get cold weather again.
All right. And the insurance cost, when you say your growth will cover this, are you talking about the growth in EBITDA is just going to be offset by the insurance, or like a partially offset? Not fully offset, I'm assuming.
Well, gross profit dollars. So, like when we look at our plan and the delta on when you waterfall it, so you've got gross profit rate, and you've got a gross profit that is sales driven. And if you look at it, I'm going to show you the number, but it's a big bar for next year. That's gross profit sales driven. All right. So relatively constant rate, but strong sales. And then you've got all sorts of costs below that. Everything from the $1.5 million in the training center to the X million on insurance. But the GP dollar delta is big. We have to achieve it, of course, but that's where the growth is next year. All driven off of sales.
Okay, and sorry, I think I might have missed the $1.5 million on the training center. Can you just clarify when that kicked in and when we're going to see that ease up?
It's in now. It opened 2 weeks ago.
And that's the cost, that's an annual cost run rate?
Yes, it is.
That's a new cost in 2019 that needs to...
Right. Now you're we're getting into, you know, we've got other cost streamlining, cost management offsets as well. You know, I can't just go through everything that's going up in cost. That's an obviously very intentional investment in our people. But when we look at our entire admin spend and I look at where something might be not as important, well, we trim that. So I'll just kind of walk back what I said. It's not all driven by gross profit dollars. We're also looking at our other costs in our system, so to speak. And sometimes they incur a cost up front, like the fair marketing lease in Toronto. We had to buy it out, but it's got a payback. We just bought our store in Moosonee at a very attractive price because that was the buyout there. So whether it's a CapEx or an OpEx, the move to South Florida, that's a one-time, but very important in terms of driving our business closer to the customer. So there's things like that going on, puts and takes. But I think the training center, yeah, it's $1.5 million, and we've got some offsets in our admin side actually to pay for that.
Seems like the insurance, though, is going to be a significant number, and you're not able to give us any kind of range of how big of an impact?
I'm going to say it's a few million dollars, and you know, it's 4 or 5 range.
All right, and then on the revenue side, I'm not sure if your explanation covered it all for me, but I noticed, I found when I go through the math, it just seems like if I take a look at the international side of it, you had same store sales up 9%, total revenues up 10% in local currencies. So really, you only, if you kind of just do the math on that, you got $2 million from revenues outside of the same store sales. But, you know, yet last year you called out, I think, $24 million of hurricane impact, and it was shrinking because you're down to only one store now. So, you know, there's probably $15 million or so that you should have been making up at least between last year's impact and this year's impact from the hurricane. So was it just not as big of an impact last year as you thought it was then? Is that what you're trying to say?
Okay, I'm trying to catch up.
Well, just
the store that's not open yet is a very large store, and it's for competitive reasons I can't tell you, but it's the largest store we have, order of magnitude of to any store in the Caribbean. What else can I say, Michael? I mean, so trying to catch up to your thinking here. So that's a big missing piece of, I think, of your equation, is you don't know how big that store is in sales.
I know you had one cost you less closed. You had the liquor store closed, but then it just seemed like my point was that you only had, other than same store sales, which wouldn't cover the hurricane impacted stores, you know, wouldn't capture that, right?
Right.
So you only, if you take out the same store sales, you probably only had $2 million of revenue growth.
Oh, of new revenue growth. Yeah.
New growth other than, you know, that wasn't captured by same store sales. But last year you had a mass, you know, you had the peak of the hurricane impact, in a number of stores. And now what you quantified as $24 million U.S. impact on revenues last year.
Keep in mind though, Mike, that we also closed a Cost-U-Less store in Q1, right?
Right.
So you've got that, all those sales are out. So that's in your 2 million delta, I think that's the number you were trying to explain. Keep in mind that we've got a Cost-U-Less store that's out.
Yeah, no, right? I know. Anyway, the point is, I guess when I did the same math in Q3, it looked like there was kind of $8 million missing from revenues, which I'd assume was because of the store closures. When I did the math in Q4, it looked like there's something like double that missing. So I don't know if it was just that, you know, you had so many extra sales right after, as people restocked right after the hurricanes, and therefore the hurricane impact maybe wasn't as big as you originally thought it was. Is that what you were trying to say earlier in the call?
That's part of it. Yeah.
All right, I'll get back in the queue. Thanks, guys.
Okay.
Thank you. The next question is from Neil Linsdell with Industrial Alliance. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi guys. Just want to follow up a little bit on the insurance costs if we're looking at higher insurance premiums going forward. For the hurricane impacted stores, you're rebuilding, but you're rebuilding to a much higher standard. And I think in Northern Canada, you've had a little bit of an issue with fires lately. Is it really all about hurricane damage, which is boosting your insurance premiums, and do you not get any benefit from your new building code?
We will, but it's everything is looking backwards. And in some of this, you know, we're doing it because there's a strong business case, not just insurance, but business continuity for other reasons. Getting the stores to Cat 5 is a little bit of CapEx in there. The stores weren't in bad shape. The ones, obviously, that did get destroyed were close to Cat 5 already. But there's been some shoring up, and then the new engineering standards for the St. Martin rebuild and the St. Thomas rebuild, and then a bit of work in St. Croix. So the insurance companies want to see that, too. So it's both us and it's them. But even when they see that, this is the way they think right now, and you know, what percentage of this is a reality based on where we do business and just where the insurance market is today. Eventually, we're going to get a lot of credit for this. Insurance, customer, community service, and business continuity. Hopefully not soon, because that means it's not a hurricane. But the point is, we're ready. We will be. Now we shift into Northern Canada, and that's actually a significant part of the insurance increase. And this is, I believe, on us. I mean, we've made the bet of where we choose to do business, and it's a very unique niche, and it has upsides and it has downsides. Net positive, we wouldn't be there. But on the downside is one of them is the insurance and the arson risk. So there are some very practical mitigation steps that are in some ways long overdue, and we've gone out and we've put that into our capital plan, and we've got a program based on risk, because not every store is the same, to go in and look at what has to be done in terms of the garbage rooms. I think I've talked about this before, behind the stores, the under padding of the stores, some fencing, this kind of thing. And as we do that and we address those stores, we expect that risk to go down appreciably. There's some wiring things we have to look at too. We had two fires tied to wiring. So we've now gone into all of our stores and looked at that. The insurance companies will give credit for doing that, but they're still going to look at your loss experience. And, you know, we've seen this where it does come back. I mean, but you have to show your loss experience to be what is more profitable for them. And that's just the way it is for 2019. And I did say that we're looking at other options, and whether it's a captive or something else, we want to explore. There was no time to do that, and again, I think we've been caught a bit behind on this because it's not the first year it's happened, but now we're totally on top of it, and we're going to try to turn what's been a cost, a cost increase into something that could be a cost decrease, but it's not going to happen in 2019. It'll be 2020 and beyond when we can come back and say we've got a different plan in place, and the mitigation plan's there, but I'm talking now about how we structure our insurance, and that'll happen in 2020.
Okay. All right, that's fine. And just when you were talking about the miss in Northern Canada, you mentioned about the inventory counts need improvement. Is that because you just weren't tracking what was being sold properly, or are you having any other kind of issues with shrinkage or something like that that's a different type of mitigation?
Well, there is shrinkage. It's higher in our stores than it is in, say, in the northern stores compared to Giant Tiger, and it's tied to the supply chain, the remoteness. But we think that we know if we're going to have a pricing system that's based on scan shrink. So just the simple point is, it's you've got a cells on handheld unit, and you scan everything that goes up, that you're throwing away or spoiled or damaged. You've got damaged codes and so forth. So we know what isn't available for sale, what's being marked down promotionally or permanently marked down. If those disciplines aren't followed, if you made a price adjustment because of local competitive activity or just because you decided to change your price, all these things aren't tracked into our central cost of goods system, which is not the final solution that we bought, but it's a proxy for what's going to happen down the road if we don't have good core fundamental disciplines. If your inventory count is wrong and you miss something and you over understate it, then it comes back to get you the next count or usually by the next one. So there's a multitude of factors here that need to be in place, and we know what it looks like when it works well. We have a very tight tolerance of our gross profit. And given that we aren't, like, the promotional activity that we would have would be much lower, and the vacillations in price would be much lower in terms of competitive-driven reasons than in southern urban retail. So we're actually in a fairly controlled environment that way. Where we're not as controlled, and this is a more systemic challenge, is I talked about a couple dozen stores, is where we have high turnover and not acceptable levels of operating stability. That is, for our president of Canadian Retail, I don't know if I mentioned this in December, 100% of his incentive is on this, is to crack this and to really focus on where we need to be on recruiting the training center. So that's longer term, of course. We need a pipeline of people and processes. But we do have processes, and we can mitigate it now, but we've got to go into each of these store situations. I'm sure there'll be some more changes that I can update you on in Q1. I regret that it had to come like this, that we had to have a surprise, but it's been on our radar. We've had it as an initiative going into 2019. It's been escalated now for obvious reasons. And those are, again, that's kind of all the things that happen, Neil, that would affect an adjustment on your gross profit. I mentioned in our staff-wide meeting yesterday that it's also a cultural mentality where if we had a cash shortage, because we're in the cash business with financial services, it's a big deal, as it would on your over and shorts on your registers every day. Every lane has an over and short report. We tend to have a different talk when it turns into inventory and we're short $3.5 or $3 million. It's like, okay, let's just peg the new number. Well, no, that's why did you have that? And you got to think about it like cash, and you've got to be on it. And that's just, you know, a way of thinking. You would say, well, why not? Well, I'm telling you, it hasn't been quite like that at Northwest. And I think the systems are dragging us that way, but also the upside in price and margin management. There's just too many reasons why we need to do it, and as I say, I'll report back as we go through the year. Our mid-year counts start to take place in late spring through to July, so we'll probably have some indications in Q1 on how the mid-year counts went and whether our tolerances are improving, and take it from there.
Okay. No, that makes sense. That explains the training center benefit in much more detail. And so let me just finish on that training center. Is that just to support or address problems that you're having in Northern Canada, or does this also apply to managers for Alaska, the Caribbean, and such, where you're going to have them training here? And are we seeing any of the similar types of problems or things that you can address?
The solutions will be different, and I think the other, I'm going to say that with the two president structure, it's an evolving view that would put solutions. We have, you know, best practice. Some of the curriculum will be standard across the company. We run the same point of sale system, so you can imagine the standard operation procedure, SOP, for the point of sale will be the same across all banners. But we actually want to go the other way and more localize and regionalize training and even recruiting as we get down the road further. So the solution that we're describing here in the training center in Winnipeg is geared specifically to department managers and store managers for our Northern Canada stores. Giant Tiger has its own training system. There's some crossover. I mean, we can run some of our corporate staff through in terms of onboarding, you know, cultural awareness and those kind of things, basics of business. But it's really about the Northern Canada stores. I don't know what the Alaska solution will look like. They'll have something tailor-made for a much smaller store division in a much tighter geography, so they could have something down in Anchorage. But as I said earlier, they benefit from a much more stable cohort of older,
right,
experienced managers. And I think there's a lot of reasons for that. And one of them includes just the ability to, in the U.S., we find that we can recruit people. They'll move to Alaska, into rural Alaska, easier than get Canadians to move into northern Canada. That's just part of it. The Costulus one will be different again. Those are very large stores. The directors of those stores are almost a VP stratum. So the way we train and onboard will likely be within the islands themselves versus a central place. So we'll have more color on that. But right now, I think the big news for us, because this is where the biggest opportunity is northern Canada, and the training center will be part of that solution.
Okay. All right, great. Much appreciated.
Thank you. The next question is from Keith Howlett with Desjardins Securities. Please go ahead.
Yes, I had a question. You mentioned that future development of Giant Tiger would be focused in northern and rural regions. I think you have 40-some stores now. What's the current composition of your stores in the Western Canada?
50% would meet that criterion, and the other 50 would be urban. And there's a subset to that. The Winnipeg urban stores, where we've got high brand recognition and a strong, what we're finding, and again, Giant Tiger stores would have a different, quite a different experience in the East. It's a different demographic too, in some ways, that we do really well in Winnipeg with some of the new Canadian demographics and First Canadian. That's a large First Canadian Indigenous community in Winnipeg. That's a strong Giant Tiger shopper segment. Filipino Canadian is a strong Giant Tiger shopper segment. And then the fact we've got, I think, 10 stores in the city. Where we've just got beachheads, like a store in Calgary, a few in Edmonton. It's a function of, can you get good real estate? Can you get all the cost factors in place? Can you establish enough of a brand presence? Do you have the right customer mix? The path of least resistance to making money sooner on a new Giant Tiger store is to be in rural areas. We find when you're not in the shadow of Walmart and you are the dominant fashion store and your discount offer and food is dominant as well, that's what we've learned. So it's finding more of that and finding less of the other. And just getting that weighting heavier towards the types of locations that have now told us that they'll make money faster.
And that was a secondary question I had. When you reduced some of your store count, I think maybe 4 or 5 years ago in Calgary,
mm-hmm.
is the big difference between Calgary and Winnipeg just maybe when you opened or your big presence in Winnipeg? Or do you think it's a different competitive set? Or
we're still not sure after all these years. The no question the cost inputs are higher, lease rates, $15 an hour minimum labor, and transportation costs, wages that cascade through the road transport sector. Everyone else puts on their pants the same way, so the competitors all face it too. But to the extent they have national pricing strategies and average their freight and do other things that don't completely incur those regional costs, that's what would bother us a bit about Calgary. If we had a bunch of stores, there'd be some scale on the brand image side, but these cost inputs would still be there.
And just on your sourcing, with your diffuse, you've got here in the Caribbean, the Northern Canada, and then Western. Are you able to procure American wholesalers, or do you go direct to manufacturers? Or I'm thinking mostly of your food business.
Right. So we are largely regional there, and as we move to this more further regionalized structures. So just to give you a little more background on the split of our Bellevue office and the closure of the office, we're moving to putting a procurement and marketing VP into the Alaska business only. The VP who is from Canada originally and was in Bellevue is now moving to South Florida with our president. and they'll be focused. Well, the president will cover Alaska and Costiles, but he'll be focused only on Costiles. We've structured that there'll be, if you want to call it, a sharing sort of table of people. Our P&M VPs will sit down in Canada with the ones from the U.S., and they'll look at where they can do cross-border joint procurement. As between the international divisions, they will both, they have a deal right now with SuperValue as a wholesaler, and they would leverage that together, the two sort of regions, Alaska and Costiles. When it comes to things like meat, we have an international deal with Cargill. So sometimes produce, you can also, you go cross-border there on your procurement. And then it can get really regional to the extent where you're procuring only on the island, literally, in terms of local manufacturers. So it's a combination, always looking to maximize, for example, on freight, the way it works with the statutes in the U.S., there's a small group of U.S. Ocean carriers that are allowed to serve point-to-point within U.S. territories and U.S. mainland. So we're a big customer of those, and obviously we combine our buying power with them in terms of our Alaska business, our Pacific business, and our Florida business. So where it makes sense, we go across the whole enterprise, buying computer systems or meat, and where it doesn't make sense because the consumer wants local goods, we don't cross over.
I see. And how many people are involved in your decision to move out of Bellevue?
55.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is a follow-up question from James Allison with Barclays. Please go ahead.
Hi. Just quickly, back on the IT systems upgrade, can you remind us what the implementation timing is for that? This is the price management system.
Yeah. It's Q2 for Canada and deferred in Alaska because of the move to Boca Raton. It'll be Q3 for international.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you. The next question is a follow-up question from Michael Van Aelst with TD Securities. Please go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. A few. First of all, when you bring your in-house, or now that you have the NSA maintenance brought in-house, is this a cost reduction versus the original plan, or just where it was getting to in recent quarters?
Against the original plan, there's a cost reduction against what we incurred in the recent quarters. Original plan, we knew from, I'll just say, pre-acquisition due diligence and some of the experts that we brought in to just talk about airlines and so forth, that there was an order of magnitude savings to go to in-house maintenance, but we had it out probably 3 or 4 years, and we were going to try, and right now there's a cost. It's not, we've looked at building another hangar in Thunder Bay, and it would ROI just based on the maintenance. Now, we're doing the maintenance with leased hangar space, and it's going to be fine. Down the road, we still may look at that hangar to achieve even more cost savings. So, am I being clear enough? In a way, we have no choice because we don't think we can rely on third-party maintenance. They're too small. They're not reliable. And it's not just, we've had some decent ones, but they're busy. And it's about getting service and priority service to turn our planes around. So there's a qualitative factor there, too. But as we scrub the numbers, yes, we expect it to save money compared to what we had before. Right now, we'd be satisfied to just, you know, do what our original plan was, which was to use third-party maintenance at a certain cost. That's kind of where we're at today. But as we look around the corner, we might have to put a little more investment in, but it looks like at ROIs that we would be able to achieve cost savings over any third-party maintenance that's out there today. I know I'm being a little bit wishy-washy on this, but part of it is, as we've learned about the space of third-party maintenance for an in-between size airline like ours is not very wide. There aren't a lot of choices. So we're not, the good news is we're not incurring higher costs. It's going to be equal or lower than our original planning scenarios. It's just that we've had to tool up, literally tools, and put more min cost into the business to get there.
Okay, and is the in-house maintenance capability for all of your fleet or just the ATRs?
All of it. We also pulled out the Pilatus from our Pilatus maintenance supplier. What we don't have in-house is our C-checks, the major overhauls, and many airlines don't. So that's left to the side for now.
Okay, and the relocation of the offices, the international offices, I know there's one-time cost in Q1, but beyond that, is it going to cost you more to operate two offices versus one? Is it a revenue opportunity strategy, or is there cost to it?
Okay, good question. And I just to clarify, the timing of the office move and the incurrence of those one-time costs will be spread between Q1 and Q2 because we don't. I mentioned stay-on bonuses and whatever goes into the one-time cost components will stretch into to Q2, Q3. We've done this on a net neutral basis. That was the challenge put out to our president, international. You know, the reason we did it in the first place, condensed the offices, was there was a cost efficiency we felt opportunity. And your point is, it's a good question, because as we push this strategy of a more delegated, distributed, you know, regional approach to running the business, that's going to be one of our guideposts, is to have offsetting efficiencies so that we're not incurring higher costs. I don't see it being a cost efficiency measure. It's very hard to do that when, you know, you know retailers in Canada that centralize their buying until they go too far and then they lose touch with their customer. Our assessment is, and I, you know, when we leave this call, we've got a blue sky meeting on, we call it T-Store, Tomorrow Store. Like, what keeps you awake at night? Besides having people to staff our stores, it's about the regional, locally owned competitor. And all they do is get up in the morning to feed their family. They come to battle against you in that island, in that community. So we do okay, but we would do better, we feel, by having the highest stratum executive that we can afford, and they pay for themselves if they're good, in that market, in that region, not in Winnipeg. So that's our approach to why we're doing it. But to get there, we also want to do it in a way that's cost neutral. And that's what we've achieved so far on paper with the planning for the Bellevue closure and the two offices in Anchorage and in South Florida. And that's going to be the model going forward. If we decide to go further and other, I say, close to the customer activities, plan, buy, move, sell, maybe some of the core HR, store HR activities like recruiting and training, we'll continue to look at the center and say, well, then we've got to make this efficient and not be cost neutral at least.
Okay, and then on the higher incentive compensation on the international side, can you explain what that's based on, like what triggers a higher incentive, given that, you know, the profit for the year and year and for the quarter, so I assume there's other factors involved?
Mike, it's the bulk of that increase was a share-based compensation component.
I thought in the international there wasn't. It was mostly in Canada.
It was. It's substantially all, but there was a smaller portion that actually hit in international operations in the quarter. And then there was, in addition to that, there is, when you look at our incentive plan, our short-term incentive plan, and you go across the different regions, there are people that within those regions that perform very well. And so there's bonus costs on that.
Okay.
I'm just going to point out that I don't think it will make a big difference, but you will see more between regions perhaps variability this way. Like, we are looking at the incentive being tied more to the region. The executives, the C-level, are on through their PSU options, have skin in the game cross enterprise, but we actually want to keep going the other way, that and incent more people on the business units they actually manage or support, and less about the cross enterprise, because we are so dispersed, it's an equity and a motivation and alignment thing. So I don't see that as a negative. As long as in total we're not driving up our comp costs, I don't think we will actually, because there'll be variability between business units. So we've modeled that, and I just want to bring that out because you will see more potential variability between businesses.
Yeah. And then final kind of topic is just on the Canadian revenues, similar to what I did before. Like, so the Callaway store was closed for upwards of 10 days, I believe. Was that a material impact at all in revenues?
It was. It's a very large store, and it was an impact.
Okay, and so because when I look at it, your same store sales and your total revenue growth was pretty comparable, but you had at least three new GT stores open year over year, and a bunch of smaller C stores and things like that as well.
Yeah.
Were the new stores fully offset by the closure of the Northern store and the Tim Hortons that you closed, or?
That's basically the math, yeah. You've kind of backed into the pluses. Yeah, that's all there is, really.
Yep.
Wow. Okay. All right, thank you.
Thank you. There are no further questions registered at this time. I would like to turn the meeting back over to Mr. Kennedy.
Okay, thanks, operator. Thanks, everyone, for being part of the call. I think we've answered everything. Whether we have any takeaways, John, we'll have to take a look after. I know there was obviously a lot more detailed questions on some of these variances, but I think the best thing here is just, as usual, to keep open communications. You know where to find John and I if you have any follow-on. And otherwise, we'll look forward to being on the call with you in June after Q1. Thanks very much.
Thank you. The conference has now ended. Please disconnect your lines at this time, and we thank you for your participation.